Well, good afternoon on this rather difficult afternoon. And Eliza is, of course, from north of England and finding it very difficult. And I'm of Irish extraction from Melbourne, and I'm finding it even more difficult, I'm afraid. So if there's... I think we'll survive, but when we might not. I doubt if many of you will have had time to read Eliza's book. She's written two books, actually, and she's 29, and that great swaggering magazine Granter has sort of designated her as one of the coming new novelists, and I think they're generally they're pretty savvy about it, because they've picked Martin Amis, Julian, mainly men, I think, haven't they?
Yes, it was a big thing about this year's issue was that it was mostly women this time round, whereas previously it had been mostly men. Yeah.
Thank you, responsive audience. Yeah. Well, they know about that. Well, Grant has said this about you. Because you're so young, and you must have written... your first novel is Boy Parts, and that was written 3 years ago.
Yes.
So very young, really. And this last novel, the one we probably will talk about today, which is about, not horror genre, it's some sort of genre that we might discover along the way, if it does have a genre. Anyway, Eliza was born and raised in the north of England and went to university in London for 3 years, where she did a fine arts degree. And her novels, both novels, I think, confirm her understanding of the difference, how England is, still two countries. You know, the north and the south, they really are very separate countries. So... today really is a lecture about Mrs. Gaskell, a long time ago, for the in-joke for the literary folk. Now, Boy Parts, it's quite amazing, because I think, like Byron, Eliza woke up one morning to discover herself very famous. And because Boy Parts went on a thing called Book Talk, and she'd sold, this was... way back then, she'd sold 60,000. It's probably sold double that by now. So at that age, to have found, to sell... I mean, in Australia, I think a bestseller is about 3,000 copies, so you can imagine. And it's... I suppose we should talk about why, if we are going to talk about Boy Parts, because it's relevant to the second novel too, to Penance. But Boy Parts, it's about a particularly horrible and particularly beautiful young woman called... Irene, is that how you say his name?
Irina,
who she photographs ordinary men she finds in the street. And the whole novel's about the pursuit of this and what happens to her. But maybe we can talk about that later, because her second novel, Penance, is wildly different, although that doesn't resile from the horrible, very horrible people. because Penance is a labyrinth of stories leading or not really leading, trying to open up a subject about why four schoolgirls aged 15, 16 would kill and murder in the most brutal fashion one of their group, a girl called Joan Wilson, and it was taken up by podcasts and crime writers. So really, Eliza's writing about... I think this book's an inquiry into our obsession with true crime. I don't understand it. I watch that American thing, Murder in the Buildings. But British crime fiction is very, very different, isn't it? But it's all very brutal. Now, I mean, I actually said it's a dizzying up. How do you say it? ARPEGGIO. This is the heat. Thank you. Arpeggio. So it is. It's page after page. Opening different people speaking. So can you tell us why you started inquiring into this. Oh, but first of all...
Yes, I was going to say, do you want to do the...
Yes, and I do, because it's very important that we acknowledge this land that we meet on today, and it's the traditional lands for the Kaurna people, and respect their spiritual relationship with the country. We also acknowledge the Kaurna people as the custodians of the Adelaide region, and that their cultural and heritage beliefs are still as important to the living Kaurna people today. Okay, with that in mind, go back to the
yes.
where it all started.
Mm-hmm.
Where?
Yes, so I started, I basically started writing penance because I had, I was signed to a 2-book deal and therefore was contractually obliged to write a second novel, which isn't the most organic way of coming to a book. But it's, I suppose it's just sometimes what happens, isn't it? When your writing sort of ceases to be a hobby and starts to be an income source. And I think a lot of the process of writing penance was sort of me kind of having to get my head around that a little bit. I always say that, like, when I wrote Boy Parts, I was like really, really angry. And I think when I wrote Penance, I was a bit panicked. I think panic is sort of the providing emotion that was coming through with that. And I had this sort of original idea for... I was kind of cribbing from a couple of different real-life murder cases. And I knew I wanted to write it in the style of a true crime book. And I started writing it in late 2019, before Boy Parts had actually come out. But... In the UK literary industry, I don't know if this rings true for Australia as well, we sort of seem to be in a bit of a thing of signing very new novelists to these 2-book deals, giving them not a lot of time to write a second book, and then everybody being like, I can't believe this second book is a worse rehash of the first book when you've only had like 2 years to write it. So I was very conscious of writing a worse rehash of Boy Parts, and I wanted to do something quite different and quite ambitious. Otherwise, I felt like I just wouldn't be taken seriously. So it was sort of, I was really coming into it with a lot of anxiety and a lot of concern about how the work would be viewed. So I sort of wanted to do something in this kind of true crime space. I knew that I had to write a second novel, and I was pulling from a couple of real life cases that were sort of similar.
Can you tell us what cases you were?
Yes. So the cases that were the biggest sort of points of reference for this were the 1994 murder of Shonda Scherer, which took place in the United States, where on the surface a lot of the features of the case are quite similar. And then the other one is the Liverpool in 1993, the murder of a young woman called... I'm drawing a complete blank. It's Suzanne something. Sorry about that. I'm blaming the heat. Yes. It's
In the north. She was,
yes, that was in Liverpool. And that case actually didn't get very widely reported on because it happened almost contemporaneously to another Liverpool murder of a toddler called James Bulger, who was murdered by two 10-year-olds, which was like a huge landmark case in the UK, and it was a complete media circus. It changed our age of criminal responsibility. So previously it had been 15 or 16 and it was lowered to 10, specifically so these children could be prosecuted. And that completely overshadowed the murder of Suzanne, whose last name that I can't remember. I feel terrible about that. But yes, those were both quite important. And I think originally I was going to more directly fictionalize one of those cases, but then I decided to move away from it and to move away from it as much as I could.
How can you fictionalize something so... I mean, what about the families, not just the victims?
I think because I was sort of wanting to, I guess, the critique stuff of true crime came into it a little bit later. And also I was aware that it was very much half an idea is to just sort of write about something that is similar to a pre-existing case. And I think once I came up with the idea for the setting, which is a rundown seaside town in the north of England, that really helped bring a lot of it and kind of marry the two ideas together and to kind of give me something a bit more substantial to work with.
And this, yes, the seaside town it's very, very important because it's so English and so decayed.
Yes.
And so class bound. And the girls all live in the seaside town that used to have, you know, in the 1950s, we'd see all these summer films of everybody went off to, I don't know, where Butlins is. Are there Butlins anywhere?
There's a few Butlins.
Butlins are there? Well, Crow-on-Sea it's called, but you modelled it a bit on Scarborough?
Yes, and which is a seaside town in the north, on the northeast coast in Yorkshire. Do you have sort of rubbish seaside towns in Australia? Or I suppose not, because you've got actual like weather here and a lot of like nice coastal cities.
Yes, I don't know. I suppose we... No, I don't think we do. No, we actually don't. Not in the same way you do, because you escape from the weather. We we don't have to in that way.
Yeah. I think, the British seaside towns are fascinating. I suppose because they began as... holiday destinations. They were holiday destinations for sort of the Victorian aristocracy. So a lot of them still have these very beautiful, very grand buildings. And people were holidaying there kind of regularly until about the 70s, like the 60s, 70s. It was quite common for people of all stripes really, to go on holidays to like somewhere like a town like Scarborough. And then it was pretty much the advent of like cheap foreign holidays completely destroyed the tourist industry in these towns that were entirely reliant on the tourist industries. So we have a lot of these like decaying, like huge hotels that are like really, really beautifully designed that are just falling completely to ruin because hardly anybody stays in them anymore. And then also the weather's terrible. So if you can get to Spain for like 100 quid versus you could go and stay in a hotel in Scarborough that's going to cost you exactly as much money, but it's 12 degrees and it's the North Sea as well. The North Sea is freezing all year round. You can go to the beach in July and it can be 30 degrees and you can think, oh, I'll just dip my toe in the ocean. It'll be like ice. It'll be absolutely freezing. So they're very strange places. You can often wander around them and sort of wonder why on earth anybody would go there. Just keeping almost entirely in mind the weather.
So a lot of people who wouldn't have a lot of money would go there and live.
Yeah.
And their caravans and their broken down sort of playgrounds, Ferris wheels and sort of Midsummer Murder, of course. Midsummer Murder's mystical people. We don't have witches and villages with murderers the way Midsummer does. But your Crow-on-Sea seems to be... it's sort of a mythical place in a way. Obviously, real, but also you polish it up to be something more. And this is where this is where you put your girls, your... complex girls, and this is an inquiry into adolescent behaviour too, isn't it? And that the people who start your girls were playing at being I don't know, you might have a word for it, they're playing at being something they weren't, somebody they thought they should be in this strange world, and then it had to become reality, and the reality was ended up with a murder, which is in fact based in this real murder. But I think it's, our lives are in many... Their lives are emaciated, except for entertainment. And our lives, I think, might be emaciated, that we have to latch on to murder and horror and all these dreadful things rather than try and be morally upright. I think we should all go back to reading Mrs. Gaskell. she's not available at the bookshop, but your books both are, aren't they?
Yes.
Snap them up later. So what? I mean, tell me about these girls. Who they are and their name. Oh my! I was saying to Eliza on the way, you won't be able to see, but they're called Angelica, Violet, Dolly, Jade, Journey, Alicia, and Lauren. And I couldn't remember who they all were, so I had my partner, who's a computer, an IT person, draw up a thing, a pattern.
We've got, we've got a sort of like chart.
If you'd like to remember them all.
I can hold up the chart, yeah.
But still, you need it because they're all terribly individual. This is what I can't... Your book is so complex.
Mm.
How did you...
It was a very slow process of... sorry, I'll give you back the chart. It was quite a slow process writing this. I started it in late 2019, and then it was published in July of 2023. I think handed in early 2022, so it was about 3 years of kind of continual sort of layering up of it. And I wrote most of it during the pandemic, as you might have guessed from that time frame. So it ended up being quite slow. I actually had the original, so I knew that I had the kind of, originally though, sorry, it's so hot. So there were going to be, I knew that I wanted to have 4 girls originally involved at, like kind of in these murders, with 1 victim and then 4 killers. And then as I started doing that, I realized it was a little bit too complicated. And then one of these girls started emerging a little bit more as a voice of reason, and I felt like it made sense to kind of take her out of the crime. So that's Jade, who's one of the characters who ends up getting kind of falsely accused of being involved in the crime and later exonerated. But the 3 kind of core perpetrators are Angelica, Violet, and Dolly, who... Angelica was kind of the first voice that I found there. And I had this awful original draft, which was about, I think, 10,000 words of written mostly just in Angelica's voice. So it was going to be almost... So the book's written in the form of a true crime, like as if it were a non-fiction true crime book with a journalist as narrator. And the... I was sort of almost going to just have this narrator like presenting these 4 different accounts of this crime, which was written entirely in the voices of the girls, kind of interspersed with some town history stuff. It's ended up being there's still like extracts of that in there, but it was a bit unreadable, that draft, particularly in the Angelica voice, because it's so grating. She's like the most annoying character, so it was very, very difficult to... Well, I just found it a little bit unreadable personally when I sort of went back to it. So I ended up scrapping quite a lot of that. And then the next kind of character that I was thinking about was Violet, who I sort of considered to be the most sort of reliable of the 3 of them, in terms of presenting the fairest account of what happened. And then Dolly, who came last, I intentionally left as late as possible because I felt like she would function a little bit better in the narrative if I didn't quite know who she was, because I felt like she should almost be a bit of a mystery to everybody around her. And then I think it was much easier for me to think about who she was retroactively when I kind of built up that character through the eyes of the people around her, if that makes sense.
And these girls, well, Dolly in particular, is obsessed with killers who you probably don't know. I didn't know until I started doing research. There is all... What is it? There's this out there, particularly in America, there are these extremely nasty podcasts and and also these things on a very black internet that we wouldn't reach, where they talk about these things and to the murderers, I'm not quite sure. There are murderers who write about killing and what they've done, and they have fans. And so tell us, can you give us a short discourse on fan fiction?
Because yes.
you've done a lot of research into, you know about this.
Yeah.
We don't, so it's interesting.
So I suppose we can almost think about true crime fandom as people engage with it in 2 different strands, where we can think of this sort of quite professional strand of podcasts and documentaries and sort of, I guess, dramatized TV shows, which seem to be coming up more and more often. Like we had the big Jeffrey Dahmer thing that Netflix did recently and the big Ted Bundy thing a couple of years prior to that.
Peter Sutcliffe, they're just... They've just done Peter Sutcliffe here now, haven't they? You recently. The ABC did it, yeah.
Oh, fascinating. But yes, I suppose that there's quite professional strand of it, which kind of is in various sort of tones and various levels of taste, where for, I don't know, there seems to be stuff that's quite, there's stuff that's quite prurient, which I think we can think of a handful of sort of true crime podcasts where they sort of lean into more of that kind of dark humour stuff, and it's maybe a little bit more tasteless and a little bit more prurient. And I suppose things that are a little bit more virtuous in the way that they present it, whether those are sort of podcasts that have like a heavy focus on victims or documentaries which are sort of engaging in kind of discourse around police brutality and that sort of thing. And then I think there's this sort of more amateur strand of true crime fandom, which is people directly engaging, usually younger women, often it seems to be, in kind of engaging with true crime as if it's like a standard fandom. So talking about true crime and talking about serial killers almost as if they were fictional characters, I think. I read a book called Savage Appetites by Rachel Monroe, which is a really interesting examination of...
Sorry, what was it? Savage Appetites?
Savage Appetites, yeah, yeah. By an American journalist called Rachel Monroe, who... has this a really fascinating examination of four different types of four specific, I guess it's like the stories of four individual women, but I guess different groups in the way different women engage with true crime as a fandom. And it's really interesting, and it ended up being really formative, particularly for the Dolly character, who is heavily involved in true crime fandom spaces online. I do always say that I was quite involved in normal fandom stuff as a teenager. I wasn't involved in true crime fandom, and that true crime fandom is considered like very fringe and very extreme, even by people who are kind of obsessively writing quite strange fan fiction on the internet. This is like sort of a little bit of a brutal nadir of those communities.
But you also, did I read somewhere you were able to practice writing by writing fan extending characters?
Yeah, fan fiction was really really important for my professional development. I would say I wrote an awful lot of fan fiction while I was a teenager, while I should have been studying for my GCSEs and A levels.
Yes, I gather you went to bars and didn't study.
Yes,
wrote fan fiction.
Which, you know, at the time it seemed like a bad idea, but it has worked out in the end. So, if anybody does have any young aspiring writers in their lives, make sure that they are ignoring their schoolwork and spending as much time on the internet as possible. It's really healthy, and it always works out.
Oh, listen, no, this is part of, take no notice of anything she says. She's satirical, ironical. The whole book is a satire on journalists, mainly tabloid journalists. The main character is a journalist called Alex Z.
Corelli.
Corelli, yes. I rather liked him as an old journalist myself, but I guess he's supposed to be a really bad character because he does... I mean, it's really many different masks. In fact, as we walked over, I was saying to Eliza, she hasn't seen, or I don't know if anybody's seen the Robert LePage... production at the Festival Theatre on The Nightingale and the Fables. So they've got these giant puppets, they've got hand puppets going across the back. People down the front are telling this story. The puppets are giving another story. You see the puppeteers enacting at the side. There's water at the front, so there's reflection here. Then there's one man coming in and saying, oh, this is a story. And other people are saying, oh, that's not the story. So really, this is the female version of Robert LePage and a lot younger. But it's a very interactive, different sort of medium. And it's quite extraordinarily complex. And it's very intellectual, really, the way you've done it
Thank you.
And it's not, you know, it's not crime. It's come from your... obsession, obviously. Are you obsessive?
Yeah. I'm quite, I don't know, quite an odd person, I suppose. But
we know your shoes say it all. Red shoes.
The sort of, I guess that kind of matrix style of the book was, I was modelling it after existing sort of true crime books that I'd read, because I did like a, I had a good run at writing it in sort of end of 2019 through to the end of 2020, and I really, really struggled to write generally during the pandemic. I think generally my entire writing process prior to the pandemic was I would go and sit in a cafe for 8 hours so I could concentrate on what I was doing, whereas I was stuck just sort of sitting in my flat and really couldn't work. And what I did produce was quite labored and quite rubbish. And I ended up feeling like part of the reason that it was so labored was just because I wasn't quite like sure what I was doing. Like, I had read true crime before, I knew roughly how a true crime book was structured, but I hadn't really like sat down and really, really thought about it. So in early 2021, when we'd just gone back into lockdown again, I thought, right, let's just sit and read for a few months. So I read
Truman
a lot.
Capote, too, didn't you?
Yes. Effect? Yeah, that ended up being, that was actually a little bit later that I read In Cold Blood, but I read I read all of Brian Masters' true crime books, some of which I was rereading. I read
Richard Lloyd Parry,
yes, The People Who Eat Darkness. But I think the one, the structurally probably the most important was Brian Masters' Killing for Company, which is a book about the British serial killer Dennis Nilsen, and sort of interweaves the story of Nilsen's crimes with the story of his sort of familial and personal history, which is really interesting. Like, there's a chapter really early on which is just about fishing villages in Aberdeenshire, because he's from a fishing village in Aberdeenshire. So that was in providing this kind of like really interesting socio-political history for him as a person and for the crimes that he later committed. And I felt like, because I knew that I wanted to have those like those town history chapters, but I wasn't quite sure how I was going to deploy them and when to do it. So those ended up being really, really important for me. Because
you've got to fictionalize the facts.
Yes, exactly. You've got to kind of almost come up with, it's rather than sort of writing, well, I guess it is, it's like writing a town history, but also while you're inventing a town history at the same time. So it was quite a lot of information to hold in your head at one time as well. I think I particularly, I actually did like a really bad job of just writing this in some ways, in terms of like the technical, like I wasn't keeping enough notes. I was just trying to remember a lot of stuff. I was having to rely on like old drafts for my information collection. I ended up kind of getting my stuff together eventually, but I really wouldn't recommend doing that if you're writing anything that involves any degree of world building. I would say to take notes constantly and as soon as possible, because I drove myself absolutely bonkers trying to remember things about Croansea, a town that I made up and kept forgetting information about.
Yeah, well, it wasn't Sebald who said you must see the fiction in facts. So if you look at the, you know, it's always individual too, the everything. And a wonderful writer, a special writer, brings to the facts a shimmer and a gleam that no one else will bring. So that's exactly what you've done. But I'm very interested in, I read In Cold Blood when it came out. I don't know, actually, a lot of you are probably old enough to remember the sensation it made, because he was supposed to, do you remember, it was about the killers of a family called Clutterbuck, and these convicts on the run went and killed the family. And Truman Capote, the American writer from the South, went in and supposedly interviewed these people, and they trusted him. I think they were they killed? Were they executed in the end? I think they were. But it actually turned, in the end, it all turned out to be, well, most of it turned out to be lies. And Capote said, well, it wasn't my fault, they lied. but yeah, it was his fault. I mean, and he sensationalised it, didn't he?
Yes. So that ended up being quite important for Penance. My experience of reading Cold Blood, because I read that a little bit later on in the process. It was sort of when I did that like big stop, and when I did that big read, that was sort of early 2021, and I didn't pick up in Cold Blood until the autumn of 2021. And at that point, the thing that I was struggling with wasn't the structure, but it was the narrator's voice, and it was who he was supposed to be. Because I'd been reading books by sort of good journalists working in good faith and in good standing, who I felt were kind of genuinely trying to present the truth, and seemed like, I guess, like, not so much Brian Masters, but like appropriately emotionally involved with the crimes, and seemed genuinely invested in telling the stories of the victims, particularly The People Who Eat Darkness. The Richard Lloyd Parry book is really, really good for this. And then I read another fantastic book called The Sleep of Reason by Daniel James Brown, which is about the James Bulger murder, which is so, like, it's very empathetic, but also very sensible and very measured. And I think it was that kind of voice I was trying to affect, and it just didn't work at all. Like, whenever I was trying to sound neutral, I just felt like the voice sounded really pompous and really self-righteous. Yeah. And when I was reading In Cold Blood, my sort of first reaction to it was like, this is some of the best line level writing I've ever read. Why do I even bother? I'm a waste of space. I shouldn't have a career. And then once I'd kind of gotten over that sort of initial reaction to In Cold Blood, which I think is I think that's a fair. I know a couple of people who have had quite a similar reaction to it, of just like, this is really good, isn't it? And then reading a little bit more about the book and the fact that so much of it was fabricated, and so much of it was kind of taking things that people had said and taking them wildly out of context or massively exaggerating them. Almost Capote kind of taking these strands of truth and building on them to make this sort of heavily fictionalized mosaic that he was far more interested in than the actual facts of the case. And I just thought there was something so interesting in that. And I think this has actually been made into a drama recently by Ryan Murphy, the American Horror Story guy. But Truman Capote was friends with a lot of like high society ladies and alienated each and every one of them by talking about them in public. Like, he was writing a gossip column about his friends, basically. And I thought that was fascinating as well. Just this sort of combination of, like, there's a lot of clapping going on over there, isn't there? This sort of combination of, thank you.
Thank you. They're very...
Thank you. Thank you. I know, I was going to say, very responsive audience. I appreciate it.
They all want to write crime novels, so they want you to...
But yes, this combination of sort of ruthlessness and fabulism, which I found really, really interesting.
Crime is fabulism.
Yeah, it is in a lot of ways.
Somebody was one of those... I'd forgotten that the wonderful David Tennant played Nielsen in the... I really hate true crime. I really find it very tedious. I can't. But I watched that because I thought it was so wonderful. And
that was actually a dramatisation of Killing for Company.
Absolutely, yeah. It was so brilliant. David Tennant really ended up looking like Nielsen, but the Masters, the chap who wrote the book Killing for Company, I have this wonderful quote. He said, "The contemplation of extraordinary human behaviour with vile effects reminds one of the fragility of human sanity." And I think, is that what we're after when we write crime? The fragility of human sanity? Because I remember I hear, look at the world now. Look what's happening in Gaza. And we can't bear it, you know. People of my generation would say that, it was unbearable. We really can't. But we didn't have this when I was growing up. We know more. I think, in fact, there is less crime, in fact, factually, isn't there?
There is, yeah.
And the world is safer. But we seem to know more about the possibilities of our awful aspects.
Yeah, it's an interesting... gap in in people's sort of feeling about the world, that a lot of people feel like the world has become more dangerous when actually interpersonal crime has dropped. Though I suppose there's an argument to be made that while there used to be a lot of interpersonal sort of violence, that a lot of that violence has been shifted to the state, and now the state does that violence. So you can kind of think of when you think of the sort of things like mass incarceration in the USA, where, you know, previously we may have dealt with, I don't know quite where I'm going with that, but I suppose I'm generally
it's the heat again. Come back.
Yeah, I almost feel a little bit like, you know, when your laptop gets a little bit too hot and it starts buffering all the time. I'm sort of buffering in the heat, but I think true crime hasn't helped that sense that a lot of people have, that the world is becoming more dangerous.
Oh, it's made us terrified, I think.
Yeah, and I think it's ended up having some quite negative effect on the justice system as well, in terms of people kind of wanting harsher sentences and harsher punishment, and there being more focus on punishment than on prevention. There's actually quite a lot. I would really, really recommend Rachel Monroe's book, Savage Appetite. She has a really, really interesting chapter in that on the impact of victim impact statements on prisoners' rights in the USA, and how there's been a huge negative impact on prisoners' rights that can be kind of directly correlated to things like victim impact statements and so on, which is probably a little bit too complicated, a little bit too big to get into here, which is why I'm deferring to a book. But I think there's a lot of really interesting things that true crime has done to a lot of people's perspective of justice and of violence. And,
Well, actually, I was just looking at the end of that quotation when he said, he talks about the fragility of human sanity. This is this wonderful writer. Is he from the North, by our masters? He's gay, and he wanted to talk to Nielsen and find out what, because he didn't want anybody else to mess up the story. But he has extraordinary pity. I think so. The other side of this crime, what you're saying, shutting down, people being terrified, he said, I think studying these terrible crimes makes one more grateful for life as it is and increases one's potential for pity. By which I mean one doesn't pity the murderer more than the victim. One pities all mankind. So he's trying to give us an education in compassion. And I think your book opens up this because I think the journalist, Alex Z. Corelli, he really does start off, he needs money. That's the other thing. He says at one stage, or Shruti, the journalist, is interviewing the journalist at the end when he's reviled by the world. And Shruti says to him, oh, yes, but you were motivated by money. And he says, well, of course, I have to have money. I need to live, basically. But he starts off as a decent person. And you're wonderful. You seem to have such fun because he's mentored by, do you remember Lord Longford? And Lord Longford, if you're old enough, you remember Myra Hindley, the Moore's murderer, with, I've forgotten the other, Lord Longford was a great friend of Myra Hindley, who, the Moore's murders were just notorious when I was growing up, when the 60s, for these two people who killed children. And I couldn't, as a child, you know, a young teen, I couldn't believe that there were people like this. But Lord Longford went into the prisons, and he was a prison reformist. He was anti-pornography. And you've made Corelli. Yes. I mean, you've had such endless fun with this.
Yeah, I enjoyed my Lord Longford cameo. I just think he's a really interesting figure. He was like an English aristocrat who was a conservative politician. And then I think he married a woman who was left-wing and had his mind open to this sort of whole new world of empathy. And he became this, like, he almost went a little bit bonkers, I think. He sort of became this prison reformer, and he took Myra Hindley on very, very good faith and tried very, very, very hard to get her out of prison in a way that was very questionable. And there's actually quite a good dramatization of his relationship. It's just called Longford, the film, and he's played by Jim Broadbent. And it dramatizes his anti-pornography crusade, which was really quite ridiculous. It was almost as if if you imagine this, just this very, very old, very upper-class British man discovering pornography for the first time in the 1970s and deciding that he needs to make a massive social crusade about it. But yes, I thought he was an interesting sort of foil to kind of throw in for a little bit of context for someone like Corelli, who... is a British tabloid journalist at a made-up paper called Polaris, which I give it the context of being like Britain's like last remaining sort of left-leaning tabloid paper that's like been dead for about 10 or 15 years.
Can I interrupt? Adelaide is where Rupert Murdoch started.
Right.
So, yes. And he is, Alex Corelli is...
I didn't realise I was at the site of the end. You were at the site of the crime. Ground zero.
Of the great... yes, but I think Rupert might have been left wing when he was in Adelaide. I can't remember. Anyway, he... Corelli loses his job because he's involved in phone hacking.
Yes, yeah.
So another... fun sort of thing.
Yeah, so I kind of wanted to suggest this idea of him just being this gradual spiral downward of somebody who begins with some scruples and then ends up having ego kind of taking over and becoming this quite sort of foul, toad-like figure.
Oh, it happens to us all, I'm sorry. That's just life. And then you suppose then you have pity,
yes,
because you've learned compassion along the way. So... yes, he's. I think he was, but he elicits because he has genuine empathy, and empathy is the thing. If you display empathy, if you ask, people will tell you anything.
Yeah,
they and really will.
It's something you can really, really weaponize. I think as a writer generally, but I think particularly as a journalist, which I was really interested in. I guess unpacking that. I don't know, that sort of slight, I guess that combination of ruthlessness and fabulism again, that it's sort of this kind of compulsion and this drive to get a story by any means necessary, I think is interesting. I mean, it's something that you can kind of, you see a little bit of even if you're just being interviewed for a paper, just for a book, that you might sort of say something where it's like not that bad, but it'll be, I mean, a good example of this. So I had a Guardian interview when Penance came out. I mentioned offhand while I was walking the journalist to the bus stop that, because we were talking about Bret Easton Ellis and he was like, have you ever met him? And I was like, oh no, but I was supposed to. And because I'd been asked to chair him for an event, and Bret Easton Ellis was like basically just said, she's too young, I would rather be interviewed by someone my own age. And I recounted this to the journalist thinking that we were off the record, but we were not off the record. And it was in the headline, and I thought,
gosh,
Anthony, you little bugger. Was but it's stuff like that where you just think that it's like if I was having a conversation with a friend and they sort of tweeted that out, you'd be like, what the fuck?
Excuse me, we don't swear in Adelaide.
Sorry.
yes. It's, yes, I know too well. But it's so tempting. And sometimes, I'm not saying this was you, but sometimes as a journalist, your subject is so dull, you think, oh, I might just polish them up a bit. And they won't be upset because it makes them shine in this beautiful way, but I don't, of course, no, I don't, I've never done that, but I wanted to, Australian horror, because you said
yes.
in an email to me that Australian horror was terribly important.
Yeah, I really like Australian horror. I think it should get more of a...
She's very mad, I think.
But I don't know.
Well,
I think
who would you like? There's a...
Yeah.
Who do you mean films or
yes,
writers?
But, yeah, like? I think I'm there's like a really good exploitation as a whole genre of horror, which I think is mostly kind of, I guess, like exploitation films that are about particularly focusing on like the outback and things like Wake and Fright, which
oh,
is...
Oh, that's very, very brilliant.
Yes. A film where you can practically smell the lager. Coming through the screen, you can practically taste the kangaroo blood. But I like an Australian. There's a film called The Loved Ones, which was particularly important for the development of boy parts, which is about a, I think, I would guess that they're living, I'm not quite sure, somewhere quite rural in Australia, a continent which is huge, but it's about a girl who kidnaps boys and keeps them in her cellar. And it's fantastic, and I would recommend it.
Who wrote it? I've never heard of it.
Yeah, it's great.
Oh, somebody knows it, yeah. Well, boy part, you reversed the idea of men always photographing women and that sort of... And that, actually, your writing reminded me very much of... Even Edward St. Albans or Will Self, that very edgy writing. Mm. It's very original. And
thank you.
Actually, I had a quote from that Australian horror writer. I've said many times that horror is the genre of honesty. It doesn't shy away from harsh truths. It follows the rabbit hole all the way down. No manufactured happy endings. You find truth in darkness.
Mm.
So...
Yeah, I think that's very accurate. I mean, I feel very influenced by horror. I don't think any of my books have been sort of classified as like straight horror novels, if that makes sense, as kind of like pure horror. But I'm very, very influenced by the horror genre. I think it's really, really important, and some of our kind of most interesting and most innovative storytelling and filmmaking often comes out of horror. And I owe like a huge, huge debt to it because I do think it's a very honest genre. I think that's a really great quote because I think, I don't know, I suppose there's just something very, very honest about the things that we're afraid of. And I think to sort of loop it back to true crime, often the things that we are most afraid of are just other people and what can be kind of hiding behind the surface of... You know, whether it's a kind of, if look at someone like Dennis Nilsson, whether it's a man who works at your local job centre or a teenage girl who spends a lot of time on the internet, there could be kind of anything going on behind there. And I think that's one of the reasons that true crime captures us so much, is that it plays into this everyday fear of, we really don't know anybody who is around us and anybody could be thinking or planning anything. One of you could be.
Why do you think they're here? They want to know how to do it. I don't know. Maybe with the horror genre. I mean, there was gothic horror, of course, in the 1800s, and the people satirized. But that was people being entertained. Not even imagine, although perhaps...
Yeah, well, I suppose that's a great... I think that's a huge genetic connection as well between, like, the Penny Dreadfuls of that era to the true crime that we have now. Should we do some audience questions?
I was just looking at the time. Is anybody... There's a mic up there, so anybody who wants to be go into the horror in their own life, could you dash up to the mic?
I wonder if you could share with us what it is you'd like the reader to take away after reading it. Is it a fear, sort of revulsion or a fear or deeper understanding of how these things come about? Or perhaps, as Ms. Elliott said, in the end, pity?
Yeah, that's interesting. I think one of the things I'd like people to come away with is, like, I suppose, like, a greater sense of empathy and contemplation around why terrible things happen when they do. Because I think often it's really easy to blame this idea of, like, somebody being, like, born evil or born bad, when I think a lot of terrible crimes like this are often kind of at the core of a failure of the state and a failure of the people around perpetrators. And I suppose I would also like people to have a little bit more of a think about their true crime consumption habits. I'm not actually as anti-true crime as the narrator of Penance is. I'm a lot more ambivalent about it, but I would just like people to just think a little bit more about it. thank you so much. Thank you.
Yes, I thought you were a bit of I was going to ask if you're a Puritan, but the next...
I'm ambivalent about everything. You'll never get a straight yes or no answer from me.
That's perfectly normal. You'll be pleased to hear. Next question.
That leads perfectly into my question, where I was really hoping for like a yes or no answer. In the very start of the book, just after the podcast, Corelli perhaps writes, "Do you know what happened to her already?"
Mm-hmm.
And that paragraph, I'm just really confused on who wrote it.
Mm.
Is it you coming through being like, here's my critique on true crime, or is it actually Corelli who really doesn't agree with what he's written there as part of the book itself?
See, I was thinking of that. It's definitely part of the book itself. I was thinking that of almost as the narrator's sort of like, as the narrator's like attempt at like a really, really strong opening that is quite like, quite self-righteous and quite quite smug.
Mm.
And I think I have almost been a little bit frustrated that sort of first paragraph had featured so heavily in the marketing, because I almost wrote it with like a kind of look on my face. Like I sort of finished the paragraph and thought, God, what a dickhead. And then it was the main sort of thing. And I'm a lot more ambivalent about true crime. I think I became quite frustrated with it while I was writing Penance, because I ended up listening to a couple of like just really awful podcasts, just really awful podcasts that really sort of strangled my faith in humanity for about 10 minutes. But I'm a little bit more relaxed on it certainly now than I had been. But I hope that answers your question. Thank you.
Hey, I'm a fan of your work.
Thank you.
Do you ever get sick of people's reactions to your book? I mean, obviously some of your work's a little bit controversial. Do you ever get sick of that? The reactions, I mean?
I try not to engage with it, basically. I think like sometimes it can be kind of a little bit impossible to avoid seeing people being outraged by it. I think particularly because I don't consider my work to be particularly like bad compared to a lot of other stuff. I kind of often refer to Boy Parts as like baby's first transgressive novel, both in that it was I'm the baby, but also the people that read it are often, I think it's like maybe the first like piece of transgressive literature that they're picking up. Because I think it is quite accessible in a lot of ways. Like it's not as violent or as kind of putrid as like as like some of Bret Easton Ellis's work, or as like as graphic as something like a Poppy Zed Bright or something like that. So I think sometimes I do feel a little bit like, ugh, it's not that bad. But then sometimes when I do go back to Boy Parts, because I haven't like read it in a long time, but I'm adapting it for television, so I have been kind of going back to it now and again. And sometimes I do read it and I think, oh, Eliza, come on, that's gross. Why did you put that in there? So I think I would have been a little bit more restrained if I'd written it now. But thank you very much.
And her parents have been told they're not to read. They've read Penance, but not Boy Parts.
Yes, they're right? Not. They're not allowed to read Boy Parts.
So you're all going to rush out and buy Boy Parts, of course. So it's yes. So there's more.
Hi, I really love your writing as like
thank you.
Character studies.
Thank you.
They're quite unconventionally abhorrent female characters.
Mm.
I think we're less willing as both writers and consumers to think of women being capable of such evil, let alone girls. And I was wondering, did that make it difficult for you to approach publishers and agents to actually be willing to take on your writing, which is quite confronting?
Yeah, I mean, I think so. Because I try not to think of myself as a sort of holy grail of transgression or anything. But in some ways, I think the work was quite confronting. I mean, when I initially sent out Boy Parts to agents, I actually didn't get any response at all. I got, I think I sent it out to about 12 agents, and I didn't hear anything. Like, I didn't even get like I got two boilerplate rejections, and then everything else was just silent. Which is a rejection in and of itself, but it's sort of almost like the lowest form of rejection, because you're not even getting a kind of like, do you want to make these changes and then maybe we'll talk or something like that. It was just nothing. And then it was taken on by an indie press. And I think in some ways the sort of the value of indie presses is for books like Boy Parts, where I guess it is a little bit more challenging and a little bit more graphic. And I sometimes, I don't know, Juno Dawson, who's another author, So I'm attributing this quote to her so it doesn't sound like I'm blowing my own trumpet, but she said that she felt like Boy Parts was maybe just like 5 minutes ahead of its time when I sent it out. And I think that might have been the case. I think if I'd sent it out like 6 months later, I probably would have had a lot more response. But maybe it was just a little bit too spicy for mid-2018, I guess. But I hope that answers your question. Thank you.
Yep. Hi.
Hello.
Big fan of your work.
Thank you.
Especially with Penance, what I really loved about it was the fact that you had so many sprawling supporting characters. So you had the tour guide, you had the teacher, you had Angelica's father, you had Jade's mother. I just wanted to know, when you were actually drafting the novel, were there any characters that you had to cut out, or do you wish had made the final cut?
Yeah, you know, that was actually, I think the main sort of clump of characters that ended up getting trimmed was, there was the MP of the town. So it was sort of, Crow on Sea is loosely based on Scarborough, and Scarborough, sort of against all odds because of how it's placed geographically, has a Conservative MP. So there was the Conservative MP, there was his son who owned the swimming pool that was closed because a child drowns there, and then there was also his son who went to school with the girl. So it was like a little bit too much lore around this swimming pool. It was just maybe a little bit too so they all went, all of the, I think their last name is Proud, and it was like that family was cut, and I think there will have been a few others. It was mostly just kind of like the odd character at the school here and there that was cut out. But that was probably the biggest thing that went. Thank you very much. Thanks.
Thanks. So, really interesting discussion. I missed the start, but have you been influenced by Agatha Christie? Because her novels and her life, there is a degree of overlap there. Thanks.
Thank you. I haven't had much contact with Agatha Christie's work at all, you know. I wonder, probably in a kind of trickle-down way, in a sort of cultural osmosis kind of way, but no, I'm not like a big reader of that kind of classic crime fiction, which is a little bit of a disappointing answer, I'm sorry, but thank you for asking.
What is the last book you've read and enjoyed?
The last book that I read and enjoyed? At the minute, I was on a panel yesterday with Jonathan Lethem and Patrick DeWitt, and I read both of their books, Motherless Brooklyn and The Sisters Brothers, as prep for that, and I really, really enjoyed that. Uh-huh. And while I was here, I was on the plane from Brisbane to Melbourne. I also read No Longer Human by Osamu Dazai, which is like a book of... Which is, I think if you like Boy Parts, you might really get on with this. It's like a very transgressive book of fiction from the 1930s from Japan. So the translation's a little bit wobbly and it's maybe a little bit difficult to understand at times. But it's a really, really interesting, really, really cool like character study. It's a fascinating book. Sorry, thank you for waiting. Sorry.
That was my fault. Sorry.
I was just interested. You were talking about when you were writing, it was during COVID and like with the lockdowns in 2021, things like that. That's a very like dark time to be researching a lot of true crime. Mm. And I was just kind of interested how you went through the writing process and like informing your novel, but also like staying above water with all the horrible information you were taking on.
Yeah, it was, to be honest, it almost, the true crime was almost ended up being like a bit of a distraction from the pandemic. The pandemic was so, I mean, it was so awful and it was so surreal in so many ways that the contained personal tragedies of true crime almost began to feel like a bit of a distraction from the kind of global horror of a pandemic, which is really grim, which is really, really grim actually. But I'm somebody who tends to like, I tend to find, because I'm a very, very anxious and quite obsessive person, I tend to find that reading about horrible things, I wouldn't say that I find it relaxing, but I find it very redirecting from my own like personal kind of anxieties. I don't know why, but I almost find it useful to redirect to something else terrible. So it was, to be honest, quite a nice distraction from the pandemic, which is so dark and probably says a lot about how horrible the pandemic was and possibly about me as a person. But there you go. I think that's probably a fun note to end on there.
Well, thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
And don't forget that you'll be over signing
books. Yes, I will be, yeah.
I have to say, after reading Boy Pastures, I was in Melbourne last week, and I was turning into Punt Road, doing a left-hand turn, and this extraordinarily pretty girl was walking across, holding up the and then she got to the end, and this Punt Road was held up because this girl was sending messages. And then as she stepped up on the footpath, she just turned back and daintily waved at everybody and smiled. And I thought of Boy Parts. I thought, yeah. Gosh, the beautiful have a different... They live on a different galaxy. So all trickles out. It's not all horror. It's all, I don't know what it is, but thank you. You've been a wonderful and engaged audience, although you didn't clap enough. Next time, please.
Yes, I was going to say we need more cheering. Thank you so much.
Thank you. And where's the signing tent over there?
Yes,
over
the signing tent's over there somewhere.
Okay, wonderful.
Yes, I can see it's umbrellas for everybody. Oh,